When they say they're mowing lawns, what do they mean by mowing lawns? Because to us, that means cut the grass and leave. To them, it meant cut the grass, pull the weeds, trim the shrubs, wash the dog, and power wash. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but to some extent, their basic lawn package was three things. And to us, it's one.
Interesting.
And that changed a lot of what we were doing. And so we had to work through that and transition all those customers. And we lost a bunch of those customers. And a lot of those customers were frustrated. And there's some one-star reviews and
There's an entire generation of Americans who no longer care about prestige, titles, work travel, fancy offices, and lunches. Welcome to Mundane Millionaires, a podcast for this generation of small business owners who want to set their ego aside and focus on what matters: family, community, quality of life, and cash flows. In each episode, Eric Pasifici and Kevin Henderson uncover what it takes to get a little money in the bank, control your time, and invest in building great families and lives. Let's get started.
So today we sat down with Nolan Gore, who we were just referring to, who owns and runs Top Choice Lawn Care in Austin, Texas, and hit on a lot of these themes talking to Nolan. I'm curious what your takeaways were, but I was struck and came away with the same thing. We got into this discussion with his latest acquisition he closed a few months ago, that the seller had taken it from zero to $2.5 million and hit a wall, and it required a completely different skill set to scale from $2 to $10 million. And this is something we found in our own business as we've had to iterate to 2.0 and go through our second phase of growth. We've heard it not just from lawn care folks. We've heard it from other folks we've interviewed in professional services, other types of businesses. Just these recurring themes, I think you're exactly right. I thought it was super fascinating to hear Nolan's story and how it's taken him, what's it been, doing the math, 7-8 years now since he first acquired Top Choice Lawn Care, to really get to the part where he's not the one out there driving the truck when someone doesn't show up for work, and that he's actually able to elevate more into that strategy and management role. But what about you? Curious your takeaways.
So let's pause first and just tell everybody who Nolan is, just a quick background on him, just to set the stage. And he does at the beginning, he's going to tell us who he is and whatever. But Nolan was in the Marine Corps for 4 years, and then he exited the Marine Corps, bought a distressed business, or what, somewhat of a restructuring situation, where he assumed the debt of a lawn care company called, I think it was called Top Choice Lawn Care at that time, whatever. But 7 years later, it's Top Choice Lawn Care. And he has grown a tremendous, I think he said it's about $1.5 million in revenue when he bought it. Now it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 8.
He
has since added an acquisition as well about 180 days ago. So a fascinating story for Nolan. He also talks a lot about his dad. That was an interesting dynamic. People say when you buy a business, make sure you've got a strategic advantage that nobody else has. And that's a great way to be successful. You look at Nolan's profile, a couple of things that he has going for himself that I like are he's a veteran. So he had that experience kind of leading men before he was in the job doing that. And then he had a dad who had run a successful, he describes him as statistically one of the best operators in the landscaping space in the world, which obviously means he's built a tremendous business. And having that backstop or that person to bounce ideas off of certainly didn't hurt anything. And it's interesting. There's a little bit of everything, Kevin, in this interview. You've got somebody who talks about family business. Got somebody who talks about buying a distressed business, then he really grows it organically for the better part of a decade.
Yep.
And then he acquires. I mean, here he is 180 days later. So there's a lot that Nolan teach other people. And ultimately, probably the most interesting part of the whole interview, and then we'll turn it over to Nolan, is when we ask him if he feels like he's, you know, gotten better at this.
Yeah.
And he says that he hopes one day he will. You know, it's that reoccurring theme of just what a challenge running a small business is. It's a great thing, but it is a challenge. And it's an open question as to whether or not, you know, I see a lot of people who've been successful.
Yep.
And it's a disaster for a decade and then they exit. Oh, that's life in entrepreneurship. So
well, and
your theme here.
And you're always being challenged by the next thing, no matter how much experience you've gotten in your lane. No, he hasn't historically acquired. So as good as he's gotten at operating, he was green through this acquisition process. And if you listen through to the end of the interview, really push and dive deep on a lot of the problems and issues that he's had to deal with in transitioning and integrating this latest acquisition, and a lot of the things that he walked away wishing he had known how he could improve on that process, because a lot of the fears of every searcher came true on his acquisition. Employees walked out 30 seconds after announcing the business acquisition. Assets in much worse shape than were ever expected, and excess maintenance. Just all of those things that a lot of searchers worry about happened in this acquisition, and he really opens up about some of those lessons learned. So really great interview. I think everyone's going to have a ton to learn from Nolan. So enjoy this episode, and we'll catch you next week. We should get a deal with our merch provider.
Yes.
We really missed Nolan out Gore. On the... Hey, guys. Welcome to the pod. Thanks for having me on. Sorry, I was going to say we missed out on the beef jerky.
We'll still work on that. Don't worry.
Actually, Jack Links never responded to me. That was quite disappointing. I thought for sure they did respond once.
I was going to say, and then I think they retweeted it or something.
And then as soon as I asked for free jerky, they disappeared, so...
I'll email who's their competitor? That's on me. This is my responsibility. Perfect. It's my fault.
There's got to be a competitor to Jack. We got to start an auction type situation. Anyways, Nolan Gore, welcome to the pod. This is episode 523 of Mundane Millionaires. I'm just kidding. We're on like 32, something like that.
This is going to broadcast in 2027 530.
We should do it. Like when you have invoices, you don't want your clients to know you're brand new. So it's like invoice like number 9,234.
Check numbers. Same thing for check numbers. Mm-hmm. For lawn prices, I always just tweak it up a little bit so it looks more legit than just me pulling a number out of my brain.
I love that. Yeah, you can't do. I had a client, they negotiated $200K extra, but they put it at 197. I'm like, this is shady shit. I don't even. Anyways, Nolan, welcome to the pod, man. Thanks so much for joining us. Owner of Top Care Lawn Solutions in Austin, Texas. Super excited to talk small business with you. You're an acquirer. You've done a number of things, Marine Corps vet. My favorite type of business buyer and entrepreneur is the veteran. So excited to talk about that. But let's kick off. Give us just a high level overview of your background, how you got from meeting your high school sweetheart in the 90s to the Marine Corps and then ultimately into entrepreneurship.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Met my wife when I was actually real little. And that is a anchoring story of the whole thing, but probably not that fun to listen to, so we won't go too far into it. Born and raised in Austin, son of a small business guy who was really good. So I was the kid that ran around and shot people with rubber bands in the business office. Still know a lot of those people because they still work with my dad, which is, it's not awkward. It's just great. I went to a small private school growing up. Started dating my wife there, went to Texas A&M, studied business there, went to the Marine Corps, married my high school sweetheart as I went into the Marine Corps, did 4 years as a combat engineer officer. As I was coming out, I was going to go get an MBA because that's what you do. You just punt. And somebody came to my dad with a business and said, hey, this little business is losing money. You want to buy it? And my dad texted me. Or called me and said, you want to put your life savings into a little business that's losing money? And I said, that sounds really fun. Let's do it. Without really thinking too much about it. I actually didn't know what the term ETA was until last year. I had to Google it. And there was a lot of weird acronyms. I couldn't figure it out.
Just to understand the timeline, when was that, Nolan?
That was 2016. So it was a little over seven years ago. The end of 2016. I got out of the Marine Corps and we drove straight from California back to Texas, and I was in an irrigation class the next week, and I joined my partner, and we officially bought it on January 1st, 2017. And I have the letter over there of the overdrawn bank account for the first couple of weeks as we were trying to figure out all of the moving pieces and stuff, because I had poor expectations for how quickly a bank can move. They don't move quickly, folks, if you're wondering.
No, they don't. Shout out to Mercury Bank, though, who does a really good job for entrepreneurs. But let me ask you an interesting question. So you were in the Marine Corps for 4 years and 2 months, according to LinkedIn. You've now been running Top Choice Lawn Care for 7 years and 6 months. Do you feel like when you wake up in the morning, do you feel like more of a small business entrepreneur or more like a Marine?
I'm definitely a small business entrepreneur now, but it does feel like it was wild when I realized that I spent more time out of the Marine Corps than I had in, because those years are so formative and they're like dog years. You just grow so much, especially like when you deploy and you're working 7 days a week, 24 hours, and except for maybe 2 hours on Sunday morning. You learn, and it's high stress, high stakes. You just learn so much so fast. So it's 3 years in one. And so obviously worked a lot of the business here, but the amount of time I put into that project versus this one over those years, I think I might just now be catching up. So small business guy, to answer your question.
And what, like during that transition, I'm curious to hear a little bit about what you found most valuable to draw on as a Marine veteran, if there are other veterans out there or soon to be veterans who are in the service trying to think of what's next. What is it that you still to this day draw from that experience in the Marine Corps daily as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, as a manager, that you think is invaluable training for what you do?
Two things that I draw on daily still are stress management and the ability to give feedback and lead people that are technically more competent than me. So what I mean by that is stress management wise, we did something stupid at a customer's house yesterday and it was just really bad, embarrassing.
Yeah.
But my first thought is no one got hurt. No one died. We can keep moving. Right. And so it doesn't mean we didn't do something bad. Doesn't mean that it's not stressful still. Doesn't mean it's not going to be uncomfortable, but it's just a different playing field. You just look at the world differently.
Yeah.
And then as far as giving feedback to people, I was an officer in the Marine Corps, so the day you commission, people that have been in the Marine Corps for 35 or 40 years salute you. And it's super humbling. And they're not really saluting you as much as the rank, but you go into these positions where you're in charge of people that have been doing this professionally for 15, 20 years, and they daily report to you. And you have to figure out how to deal with that world and how to lead them in a way that's worth following. And so I understand what my skill sets are. I'm going to lean on what your skill sets are. And I'm going to let you do that really well, but I'm still going to hold you accountable. And I'm going to figure out how to communicate around that. And we're going to work really well together. And that was the same thing. I came into the business here at 26, 27. And I think I just turned 27 and everyone was older than me. And everyone had been doing this for a lot longer than me. And I had to just earn it over a long time. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what does that look like? So if you're that 27, 28-year-old entrepreneur, you now have a 45-year-old employee that's been doing it for 20, 25 years. Like, just practically speaking, drill in on that for a second. Like, how do you overcome that kind of worry? What skills are you drawing on, or what advice do you have for those folks who have to figure out quickly of, man, I'm way out over my skis, but I need to figure out how to get these folks to follow me?
I don't want to overcomplicate it. I think a big part of it is understanding your lane and showing that you're worth following. And so I'm never going to be as good as Rogelio with a weed eater or installing sod as Chewy. They do it all day, every day. They're masters. But I can show that I can work hard. I can get out there and run a mower with Rogelio and make him understand that I want to work hard and I care about his work and the honor of his work and efficiency. I can carry a whole bunch of dirt and sod really fast for a long time with Chewy and show him that I understand his work. But what I can do better than him is plan the day, give him the tools he needs for the day, articulate the importance of doing things a certain way when it comes to relationship with the customer. And he knows that's my role and my job is to provide that work for him and continue to do that for a long time. And if we can have that symbiotic relationship, we both win. Now, would he say it that way? Probably not. But the guys that have been around, Chewy and Riley, have both been around for over 10 years before I was here. Yeah. And so those guys have grown a lot in their own personal take home, but also just the pride of being around an organization that's grown as much as we've grown. They're the OGs. Yeah. Like they're proud. They have little signs. They have parking spots. Unfortunately, they ride together because they're brothers. So they don't use two parking spots. They just use one. I love that. Come on, guys. Like, just take two cards just so you can rub it in.
Or just put in the line so you're covering off both spaces.
Yeah. And as part of, if I'm hearing you correctly, you know, part of what you're saying is have the humility to openly recognize what your lane is and what your team's lane is and defer to them where they're really experts. How, just from a practical perspective, I'm curious to hear, you had these two guys specifically you mentioned who had been in the business 10 years before you even got there. How much, just as a strategy, did you rely on sort of going to them and working with them during those early transition years to get their buy-in, seek their advice for how they could be managed better and things like that? Just talk strategically for a second to folks who are recently closed or about to close a deal and just how they can be strategic in using the people who have that know-how that they don't.
I think that most small business buyers should think less strategically and more operationally and act as a good actor over a long period of time. And that's what's going to ultimately matter.
Yeah.
Most people overthink about how I'm going to go and do these. How am I going to go connect with the people? How am I going to set up the business for growth and success? And really, you just got to be in there, especially with something really small. So when I got in, it was 1.6 million. We were tiny. Right. And so I was the driver 2 or 3 days a week when someone didn't show up. So I was, by nature, the guy in the truck with those guys.
Yeah.
Don't think I would reckon. It was great. I'm really glad I had that experience. It would have been ideal for me to use my skill sets elsewhere, but I learned a lot in that time. And so I think that really you get one day a month to think about strategy and you get the other 30 to go and do the things. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the right ratio for a small business for the first year or so. And then you can start giving yourself 2 or 3 days a month. And if you're getting into it for that stuff, it's going to be a long struggle until you get to the place where you get to spend that kind of time. I haven't experienced a bigger buy, so I don't know.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I think that veterans make the best business buyers is that they're accustomed to being leaders of men. You were in the Marine Corps, you had a lot of guys looking to you and you had to lead. And you walk, and Josh Schultz at Canecast posted this just iconic photo. And he's since taken it down. I understand why he probably did. But it was an incredible picture of him standing in front of a group of guys in a dirty room at a foundry on the first day of the transition. They've just acquired the business. And Josh has to get up and explain to these guys that they're the new acquirer and he's got to get them to buy in and not walk off the job and whatever. And I think that picture was very powerful to me because I don't think that a lot of people appreciate how challenging of a moment that can be. It depending on the nature of the business, obviously if you buy an accounting firm or whatever, it's not the same significance. But when you got to go and convince that 65-year-old dude that you're the guy that's not going to mess it up for them because their livelihood's riding on it, the stakes are high. And I think veterans just naturally bring that to the table just based on your experience. But do you think that's teachable? Would you, if you had not had that experience, would you still want to buy a business and try to stand up in front of that group of guys? And I know your thesis was, or your statement was, be a good guy over the long haul. But I want to push on that a little bit because I do think that you got it. There's the stuff that's between the lines, right? They're looking at you going, hey, does Nolan have what it takes to run this business? Because if this goes down, I'm going down with it. And so is my family. And they're out of there fast. So in the absence of that leadership experience, do you think buying a business is a good idea?
I think that knowing and being confident in your experience and capabilities of leading men is one of, if not the most important thing you got to assess before you go into a business, or being sure you have some sort of partner or person in place that wants to be that leader. It doesn't really, of course, you've got to be able to execute from a bottom line perspective. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how good of a leader you are. But if you can't deal with the humans, that's what's going to break you. And that's what's going to sink the whole thing. That's what leads to all the other things falling apart, because those fires are the ones that eat you alive emotionally and operationally over time. I remember that picture of Josh. It was a great picture. And really love Josh. He's been helpful to me. We live pretty close to each other now, which is fun. So he's I will say home. That. Yeah, he's always gone. And the last time I texted him and he was home, he was like, sorry, dude, I've been gone for 6 weeks and I'm leaving again in a couple of days. And is it okay if I hang out with my family? And I was like, yeah, actually, that's not true. He said, I'm going to hang out with my family. He didn't. And I was like, that is the right decision.
I was going to say, how polite of him to ask. No, is it all right?
He just said, yeah. It was one of those questions that was not really a question. Like when I asked my kids if they'll take out the trash. Hey, will you do this? Right. To answer what you also asked there, I think that I personally, for better or worse, have that weird overconfidence that I would feel comfortable doing it because that's what I've always done. I always have wanted to be the person in front of the room. I've always been the one that wants to make the decision and have the ball at the end of the game. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't a good enough shooter to warrant the ball at the end of the game, but I had that personality. And so I probably would have taken that risk or done something similar to it had I not had the military experience. I think that a big part of my choosing the military was because I had that wire loose in my head rather than I had that wire come loose while in the military.
Let's talk about the other element of it, though. Obviously, you've got the experience leading men. You can stand up and you've got the intangibles. Now you're taking over a business. You've left the Marine Corps, which I've never been in the Marine Corps. I don't think you're, are you managing a P&L in the Marine Corps? I don't think you are. Oh. Not really. Maybe that was a stupid question. Within your group, maybe there are some financial components. But anyways,
set that responsible for a whole bunch of equipment. You have a really high responsibility level for personnel. And I didn't even realize that it was a strange thing to be responsible for a convoy of 100 vehicles and 200 guys. But that's a thing. You just do that. But it wasn't like an understanding of here's what you bring in, here's what it costs. If you don't figure out how to get that under control, you die. Totally different ballgame.
Now, you had studied finance at A&M, so you had the financial education, at least a baseline financial education. But you take over a business that's struggling. You're fresh out of the Marine Corps. Talk to us about learning how to manage a business like that on the fly and correcting the ship and then growing it. And where did it, what was the I think it said on your website, it's an $8 million revenue business today. Where did you start and what was that experience like?
So I'm a cheater. I highly recommend cheating whenever you can and just use everybody else's resources. And I guess it's not really cheating. My dad is very
successful. To be clear, if his wife, if your wife is listening, you mean...
Listen. What I mean is I go and use other resources. Thank you for that. I appreciate you.
Or if the IRS is listening.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so, it wasn't as fun. It's not as, that's not as pithy of a way of saying it. Okay.
But what do you mean cheat? So what were the resources?
Sorry, you came on a podcast with a couple of lawyers.
What resources? Did you hire a fractional CFO? What was the...
I don't think it's that complicated. You try to figure out how to make more money coming in than you spend. And then you start getting a little bit better at understanding that and a little bit better at understanding that. And at the beginning, let me back up and then I'll tell you what some of the big steps that I did. So again, my dad's a small business guy. He's in the same industry as me. So I had a cheat code there. My business partner, mm-hmm. he was here before me. So I bought in and he actually earned ownership. We gave him sweat equity. I mean, he's still my business partner. We actually had a big, hard season in 2020 that we can talk about because we were equal partners up until that point and we are no longer. But he was there and that helped me a lot too. Was that planned? No, I didn't know what I was doing. It wasn't like we understood that. But then three, I came in and it was like, okay, I just got to figure out how to make sure we make a little bit of money next year and pay for me. That's it. That's all I got to figure out. And if we then grow, cool. But I don't even think I thought about growing. I think it was just like, hey, I'm here. I live 5 minutes that way. I'm a guy. I'll drive the truck when no one shows up and let's see if we can figure out how to make money. And it was like, raise prices. That's uncomfortable. We're going to do it. I don't know if you guys know anything about that. And then it was, I went line by line through the P&L and was like, do we need this? And my partner's, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. Do we need this? I don't know. What do you think? No. Do we need this? We just went through it all.
Sounds like a no.
And it was a lot of that, right? It was just a lot of figuring out how to get going and move through the things and ask people the right questions. And then we edged a little closer to figuring it out and then edged a little closer. And 7 years later, we're in a better spot. But it's still hard. I'm still sat in that room over there. I don't know, 10 days ago, 14 days ago. And was like, dude, I don't know what we're doing. I don't know how to get this thing to work. Are we going to figure this out? And like drawing on the board, trying to solve the problem. Cause it's still ours. It's just a different problem today.
What was the revenue amount when you took over?
Did you?
It was 1.6. When you say eight, we just did an acquisition in December. So 4 months ago. And the accounted person decreased. We're on track to do eight this year. So I had never booked an $8 million year so far.
But what were you pre-acquisition? So what did you grow the original Top Choice from that 1.6 up until you combined in December?
We grew to six, just under six. So about a 4x so far.
Okay. That's still incredible. I'm curious, just quickly, did you fully appreciate when you were buying into this business that losing money, a distress situation, what that meant and the incredible hill you had to climb? Or was there, I'm just asking candidly, a large element of kind of naivete of, ah, cool, okay, yeah, we'll give that a shot. And I'm just curious for people, myself included, if I'm looking at businesses, if I see a business losing money, yeah, I know a lot of entrepreneurs see opportunity. Like, I'm turning and running the other way, not just walking, just because of the risk there and my own risk aversion. I'm just curious what your calculus was and how you went in mentally, what you expected and how that stacked up to what these last 6 or 7 years have turned out to be.
First of all, I'm a pretty high risk tolerance person. I have a pretty high self-confidence factor, and I was still pretty young, and at that point, it wasn't like it was a huge personal guarantee. And even then, that hasn't historically scared me. Now that's famous last words, right? So I just believe in betting on myself and enjoy that. Now it's really stressful some days and I feel it heavily. But more than that, I feel the weight of the 80 families that need to go eat next week. My family, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to go figure it out. I can do 10 other things just because I have a fantastic connections and great education. But this is what I want to be doing. And I think probably the highest ROI, both from a financial and a community perspective. And so it was never, that wasn't that scary to me. To really answer your question, though,
yeah,
a lot of naivety. That's great. That's how you have to be to go into these things, or you have to be really confident and competent. And I wasn't that at that point.
Yeah. Just to clarify, what were the do you mind if I ask what the economics of the initial buy-in were? What did you pay?
You are welcome to ask that question. The embarrassing thing is, I have no idea, because it was like, you can just have it if you assume the debt. How much debt? No idea.
Interesting. Okay.
And so we just took over the debt.
Part of the problem. Part of the reason we're losing money.
Totally. Did you lean on dad? Did you say, hey, dad, look at this for me. Is this a good business?
More than anything, he looked at it from a reputational perspective and an opportunity for his son to go get his ass kicked and learn. I think he's got an analogy that I actually really love. It's like, not an analogy, whatever, an idea that I espouse to at this point, which is there's a lot of people that have great stats for being a business operator. Yeah. And let's use athletes as an example. So this guy runs a 4.3. He's got huge hands. He's got a huge vertical. He's got everything you need to be an all-star NFL receiver. But until he gets in there, Jerry Rice didn't have all that stuff. Yeah, he's a great athlete. But like, you don't know until you see them play for a long time if they can actually do it. Same thing goes with business. There's people, example that my dad uses. There's a guy that had all of his stuff figured out. He had a zero inbox every day. He had the perfect pedigree to run this department in his business. And it just wasn't making money. And the guy had to leave for family reasons. My dad was like, ah, shit, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, hey, Bob, you're in charge. The guy's name is actually George. George, you're in charge until I find someone else. And George didn't have any of this stuff. And then like within a month, it was making money. It's like his desk is messy. He didn't have any education. But for some reason, there was just like a little bit of money being made. And then there was more money being made. And George is still working with my dad, kicking ass every day. one of the most successful guys in the industry at this point, because he knew how to do it. And you just wouldn't have known until you gave him a shot. And so I think in large part, I don't think my dad would say this, but I think it was like, let's see if no one has it. Let's go put him in. Give him something that's not going to sink him and his family totally, but let's make him put some skin in the game and go see if he's actually good at this thing. And if he's not, it stinks, but he'll survive and he'll go do the next thing. If he is, this is his chance to go see it, because you really don't know. I think there's that great Brent Beshear idea of there's just the only way to figure out if someone's good at running business is to let them run a business, but it's just a high risk to let someone run a business. And that's literally it. And so yeah. I might be someday good at running a business. We have yet to see, but I look forward to figuring that out. And I feel pretty confident that someday, maybe in a decade, I'll be there.
So I'm glad you mentioned Brett, because Brett Beshear, the founder of managing director of Permanent Equity, Brett has a concept or an expression that I think about daily, which is all small businesses, all businesses generally are loosely functioning disasters, which makes me feel better in one sense and also not better in another sense. You've been at this for 7 years. You just characterized yourself as hopefully one day being good at this. It's really hard and it's messy. And I'm starting to wonder if it'll ever get better. Not in a sad sense, but in the sense that, do you ever get to a point, do you think after 7 years of this, that you'll ever get to a point where you say, I'm really good at this? Despite all objective evidence, I've built a $50 million revenue business from scratch. And you look in the mirror and you go, I'm really good at this. What's your take after 7 years of this?
I hope not. I don't really want to have that attitude. I don't think it's particularly honorable. It depends on how you say it. I'll back up and say, I remember a very stressful day. I had just gotten into an argument with an important employee. And I called my dad and I said, is it ever feel more stable? And he goes, nope, immediately. I was like, oh, great. It actually made me feel better. Like, okay, cool. I'm not crazy. I will say that I feel much more comfortable with where the business is at now than I did 3 years ago, 4 years ago, because there's more people to rely on and one person leaving is less tenuous. And that's a big deal. And that means I'm less important as well. But really, to get to your ultimate question, I have seen my dad say, because he is actually one of the best in the world from a landscaping business perspective, like statistically. He runs one of the largest landscaping companies in the world. And it's his second one to build, and he built it while you're building another company. And I have seen him say, hey, look, I am one of the best at this. Therefore, I have opportunities to help train and lead other people and give other people opportunities. And I think there's no point. False humility is silly, but recognizing that it doesn't have anything to do with your actual worth as a human is the important part of that. I hope to really, to answer your question, I hope that there is a day where, God willing, I've built a really large, successful business, because that would be fun. And there was great turnout or outcome for my family and my team. And I think that I'm supposed to go do that, and I'm going to go try to do that. But I hope also that I'm not satisfied when I still understand the things that I can improve. And I also hope that I don't view my self-worth in that. And that is going to be a real challenge. I already know. It already is a challenge. And so we'll see where it takes me, and we'll see how God shapes me.
When you look at your dad, who you've described as one of the best in the world, what is the secret sauce? What is he doing differently than everybody else to have built a business of that caliber?
There are some operational things that he is excellent at. There are some intellectual, like just horsepower things that he is extraordinary at. And there are some relational things that he's very good at. And so to give you points on each of those, operationally, he's extraordinarily good at figuring out incentive systems, specifically for middle managers. I've seen some of his middle managers go from frontline janitors, because he ran a janitorial company too, up to making $200,000 with no education, just because he found them, identified them, and trained them and gave them a system to operate in, and that worked really well for him. So that's just one thing operationally. He's just naturally unsatisfied and itchy which is a hard way to live, but really good when you're running a service business. Cause he just, if you travel with him, he just gets angry because it's taking too long. But so there's that operationally. As far as relationally, he's just been a man of character in this industry and in this town for 40 years. And people know that they can trust he's going to do the thing that he said he's going to do. And that's really powerful when you have that much momentum. And so it makes selling and growing and hiring and overcoming mistakes easier. But you paid the price for 40 years to get to that point. I said something else in there that was really smart, but I don't remember my third point. But
Texas governor, when he was on the debate stage, he was talking about the
Rick Perry. I got Perry, three reasons. Yeah. One, was, two, and
I can't remember what the third one is. Do you
something
you
in the water in Texas?
The characteristics that Dad has, is that was he born that way, or is it learnable?
That was the third point. Intellectually, he's just really smart. It's statistically, you can look at like his scores. When he was coming out of college, he took the GRE, the MCAT, the LSAT, and one other, and he was in the top 5% on all of them. Yeah, I don't have these skills. And he couldn't decide what he wanted to do. And that's how he ended up doing business, is because he just like fell into it. He couldn't decide if he wanted to be a lawyer or a doctor or get his PhD. And so what does he, some of that, the character stuff, I think is developable, but not easy. Anybody, God willing, can go and develop the character, whether or not they'll have the ability and the emotional intelligence to apply that to relationships is a different story. Whether or not they have the natural leadership tendencies and abilities to be followable, it's a different story. You don't really know if you're followable until people follow you.
Yeah.
I think that's another thing to look about if you're going to go buy a business. Do you have a track record of people wanting to follow you? I don't care if it's beach class, a football team, the military, whatever. Do people actually want to follow you? And the only way you can tell, it's like light and darkness. It's defined by the fact that people followed you, not by anything else.
Just need to go try.
And he did it. And so, and of course, there's some factors of luck and all the things, and he would tell you that. But his record showed that it's all luck.
Last question on Dad from me. You guys get along? Are you guys close? You want, is he kind of guy you want to, you get the Thursday night, you're free, you want to go grab a beer, you call Dad and say, let's grab a beer?
Yeah, no, we're really pretty on close. I wouldn't say we're, it is a good representation of how I want to have a relationship with my kids. I don't buy into the friend thing. Like we're not friends in the fact, and I'm close to him and I love being around my dad and I look for opportunities weekly to have that opportunity. But it doesn't happen every week, but yeah, he's really smart. He's really thoughtful. We understand the same things. We read a lot and talk about a lot of things. We're also okay being quiet. We try to do a father-son trip every year with my brother. Last year, we went to a big conference. The year before that, we went to a safari, which is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. So oftentimes, we'll do like a hunting trip or something. I'll probably go over and try to watch the Masters with him in a couple weekends here. But no, I have deep respect for my dad. A big part of my personal story is like, what's the American dream? Do better than your parents. Big part of my personal story is to come back and accept the fact that I'm going to enter the same industry in which my dad is world-class and likely will never pass him, despite being really good, if I get to be really good. That's okay. It also feels like cheating, right? Like my dad went from farm boy to this. I'm going to go from son of the really good guy to this.
Yeah.
It's okay. This is the story God gave me. This is where I get to go spend my time and energy and bless people and be part of my family. And doesn't mean I'm not going to try to beat him. And hell, I'm going to do my best. But it's probably.
Does he know you're coming for him?
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it.
And I think he would love that. I think he would try to win and be happy if he lost.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
My parents beat me in all the games growing up. There was never an easy win.
Yeah.
That was our family.
Let's talk about the recent acquisition. So you bought in distressed situation 7 years ago. You built the business up. And in year six, if I'm tracking, you decided to tack on another business. Tell us about the acquisition.
So one interesting thing that I've gotten a lot of affirmation on is once you're in a business, you get a lot more opportunities and more businesses. Mm. And so whether it be in your industry or you have a track record, therefore people look to you for more opportunities. And so I try to get lunch with a bunch of guys that cut lawns all over town. And I've been getting lunch with this guy once every 2 or 3 years for a while. So that's not very many lunches if you're doing the math. And we got some enchiladas and he talked to me for over an hour about life. And then at the end, I don't know if he was working up to courage or feeling me out or what, but hey, I'm thinking about selling. Would you be interested? And so the trick on buying a business or finding a business is just iced tea and enchiladas is the big takeaway here.
Hot damn, I'm going to have 50 businesses by the end of the year at that rate because the amount of times I'm at Agave
Azul. Switch from pizzas.
All the time. So I that must be my problem.
You got to get down here with the normies, Kev. Yeah, absolutely.
We worked through the problem. We didn't have any... He didn't have anybody help him. He had one kind of financial guy that had been doing some book stuff for him, help him. He wasn't talking to other people. My goal was not to have it. My goal was to be fair. Of course, I'd love a good deal, but my style is just to be fair. Let's get it to a fair place. And let's be clear, the skill sets that takes from going to from a zero to a $2 million business or $2.5 million business where he was at, one, that's really hard and most people can't do it.
Yeah,
and that's very honorable. But that skill set does not apply to going from a $2 million business to an eight and then from an eight to a 16 or whatever. Those are different skill sets. And he was at his capacity. So this was an opportunity for him to step out from where he had been successful. And then I had just done this playbook. It took me 6 years, but I played this playbook, a business that was struggling at about this size. Let's go and add more customers and add more services to those customers and raise those prices. And all of that sounds really good in theory. When you actually execute it, it's really freaking hard. Yeah. So we closed in December. And guys, I'm not very good at this yet. Maybe someday, again, I will be. But like the first one was hard. Took a lot of resources. I'd already had a really hard year. I think we paid a goodish price for it. I had some friends help me that had done a bunch of this stuff. And we covered ourselves really well and professionally, and it was still really hard. In the first hour, I had several people quit. That was spicy. In the first like 30 seconds of the crew, I had one person be like, and I was like, yes, sir. He was like, no. I was like, what? And so by that, within 30 minutes, three guys had quit. And one guy we had previously hired and fired, so I wasn't going to keep him. And so we had lost four guys.
Yeah.
The office team had all cried at that point because he hadn't told anybody. In retrospect, I would definitely require some people being told. And it's been a challenge. We're only, I don't know, 120 days in at this point. And we've gotten a lot of the hard stuff done, a lot of the services integrated and crew integrated. We lost a bunch of the team that didn't fit from a core values perspective or a competency perspective, despite the fact that we, of course, wanted to keep all of them. We just needed to make sure we held firm from an excellence perspective. And, and then we had some real significant issues with assets. The vehicles were in really much worse shape than we expected or required. And that caused a whole bunch of difficulties. We were selling almost all of them. And we had to go and keep 25K that we'd held back and then go back for another 25K. And honestly, the seller was very honorable through the process. Of course, it was not fun for either of us, but he handled it really well. And that's where we're at today. We're still struggling through it. And there's still lots of conversations every day about fixing things, but we're getting real close to where we're operating as one unit.
Yeah. Looking back, are there one, two, three things that you wish, man, if I had known this or someone had talked to me about this just from a transition period, things could have gone a lot smoother?
If you talk to anybody that's done a significant number of acquisitions, Mike Botkin in this industry.
Sure.
He's got all these stories. None of these stories are unique.
Yeah.
They're just unique to me because I never experienced them. Now, is he better at it than me? Yeah, way better because he's experienced them and he's just smarter and better looking than me in general. But I think that he's, what is he? You're probably close to him, Florida guy. Whatever.
I was more of a shot at Mike than you. Your beard is, I got you at least at an 8.5 with that beard. Please continue.
I came on here wondering when and what was Eric going to rate me at? And that was the moment. And I'm here.
Right now. And
there you go.
At least 8.5. I haven't.
We try and lay it in
higher than I expected.
Yeah.
There's some big things. I'm not the guy that you should listen to from an acquisition or transition perspective. I'm just the guy that's going to say, I'm glad we did it. It's been a really good learning experience. We're going to be way better next time. I can do a better job of setting expectations and knowing where to push harder and where not to, doing due diligence, et cetera. But nothing that's like super applicable to someone that wasn't in my scenario.
I think it is, right? And it's not necessarily the exact issue, but these issues generally, thinking through how to solve these problems. Because really what you described is a couple of things. You had issues with employee transition. You had people who quit on day one. That's everybody's biggest fear, is that everybody's going to quit. Then you had issues with, obviously, the transition. Should we have notified them in advance? How do we handle a day one announcement? And then we take over a business that has severe degradation or issues with the functioning assets of the business. And how do we solve that problem? And how do we fix it in the future by trying to identify it in advance? Because we see this a lot in deals, like towing deals, moving deals, any deals that have large equipment in it, you almost always have seller's counsel that say, you're going to take those assets as is. Yeah. Or you can come inspect them before closing. But how realistic is that, particularly when you're talking about a lot of trucks?
And specialists that can diagnose from sight. It's just, it's unreasonable.
It is. And I certainly appreciate the desire of sellers and their counsel to limit their clients' potential post-closing liability. But as a buyer, these are issues to think through. So let's take them one at a time. So the employee transition, you had people that quit on day one. That is almost every buyer's biggest fear. Let's talk about how would you have approached it differently to try to prevent that. And then it is what it is. They quit. How did you deal with it? And how big of a fear should that really be for people? Because it is the biggest fear, I think.
In retrospect, the people that did quit at that moment were people that probably wouldn't have made it anyway and showed that with their actions, their rash actions right then. Because at the point where they raised their hand and quit, there wasn't really any reason to. They could have just not showed up for work the next day or waited a couple hours. Now,
it was almost an action of spite, in other words.
I think it was attention seeking.
Yeah.
Now, I'm hearing my side of the story. They probably have some other reason they could articulate than this. Now, what I could have done is I came in a little too high of energy on that conversation specifically. I think I did a very good job on the office team, understanding the specific scenarios they were going to be in. Or the emotion we're going to be in. My best friend, who's at Brent Schools, he said, it was not a new thing to us, but Sarah, they're going to be shocked, angry. They're going to resent you, and then they're going to come around and accept it. And I could just watch that cycle through the team. And I think that I understood that and did a good job of working through the office team. I should have required the seller to tell one or two people that were really had been around for a long time that needed that emotional space, but I didn't. And then from a crew perspective, there was probably one person from a leadership on the crew team that had been around for a long time that needed to hear before that day, because he went into just a black hole. And I could have used him as an ally to be like, guys, I knew we're going to give it a chance. Let's do it.
Let me jump in. Why? I hear that. And I work for a business. It pays me a check. I come in on a Monday and Kevin is telling me that, hey, you no longer work for me. You work for Nolan. And why am I having a visceral, angry reaction to that?
What's the fear reaction? I think it's fear and uncertainty and change. We're a different thing. And to be honest, they got away with a lot. It was not the tightest. And that's part of the reason we were in this position. They weren't the tightest organized like ship. Things were loose. They got away with a lot. And that's not all bad. I'm not saying it's like me versus the crew. Mm-hmm. But in order to pay the crew what they want to make and to give them the opportunities that they want, we have to run a extraordinarily efficient operation. And we have a culture of really assisting each other, which is not what they did. Again, not better or worse in that case, but it's not what we do. And so they could sense very quickly the expectations for what I'm supposed to do are going to be different. And then it was only 10 minutes away, but we moved offices day one. And that's 10 minutes of traffic and that stuff mattered more than I thought it did. At the time, this is great. They're really close by. It'll be easy. It was not easy. It was a big thing to overcome. So all those little minor things add up. If you have to drive to a different place for work and you have to report to someone else and you have to use this one app to sign in, I was already thinking about switching jobs. Like, this is the moment. So I could have just been a little bit less energetic on that first moment with the crew, and I could have been more understanding of the places they were in and done a more thorough job of understanding what their expectations were and addressing them directly than I did. And we got through it, but it was harder than I think it needed to be.
Let's push on that. Tell me concretely, you do this transition again, you buy the same business, same people. Walk us through exactly what you would do differently this time.
I'm not going to use specific names in the business, not because I think that they would care, but just to protect them. Sure, I would tell the seller,
of course,
there's, now that I know the people, it's also a little bit different, right? Because people that I thought were critical ended up not being critical. Like, the three people that I expected, like, were in the document, says you have to do everything in your power to keep these people around. Two of those people are not here anymore. Two of the three, which is wild.
Mm. Is that something you, in retrospect, you could have, is there a way you could have known that earlier had you done something differently? That was just something you had to figure out. Yeah. Okay.
I had to figure it out. It was a culture and competency thing. And I needed to have them in my office with me for months to figure that out.
Sure.
And it's not to say I don't like one of those people I really liked, like, a lot. Like, that was one of the hardest things. This whole thing was like, I really like this person. They just don't fit. There's not a play. They just got to figure out how to help them do the next thing. That sucked a lot. In retrospect, I would say, hey, these people that have been with you for a long time, I believe very firmly you need to tell them. Ultimately, I'm not going to force you to do that. I think some people do force, and it's okay and honorable, but I would not force, but like, you really need to do this. I believe it's the right thing to do, and I feel very strongly about it. To your point, I don't know if I could have inspected the vehicles to the point, but I would have had more space for clawback on vehicles functionality, and I would have made sure that the seller understood what my expectation from that was. John Wilson made a great comment on Twitter beforehand, being like, hey, just don't buy the vehicles. If you're worried about them, just buy everything else and make him keep them and sell them. And I really wish we'd done that. That would have saved a lot of headaches and a lot of dollars on both ends, because we paid taxes on every single one of those.
Yeah.
So I wish he would have just kept the assets and sold them himself. And we would have just said, what do you think the assets are worth? Take that off the purchase price. Because, man, that's been really hard. And, man, I would have understood and done a better job of making sure that the seller at least split the cost with me over how we were going to do vacations that were expected and stuff. And that was just something that we weren't in the position to manage because of how we paid for the business. But I feel like we could have taken care of the team better in that regard. And that was disappointing for me. I still feel bad about it. I don't know. We did it. That's where we're at. Those are some concrete things, I think. I don't know how tactical that is.
No, I think that's super helpful. So here you are 120 days in. You've had to make a lot of changes. You mentioned especially the difficulty of the transition of the team. People were crying in the office. What does that look like 120 days in? How has that work panned out in terms of integration? Or are people bought into the vision of Top Choice? Are you still actively working that integration phase? And what did that look like over time?
I think we have another 9 months to know if this is really how this really went. And I think that I need to keep telling myself that so that I have grace.
Yeah.
Because especially in a seasonal business, we got into early March. In theory, the season's changed, but it just hasn't quite changed. And it was just like, what the heck have we done? We're just burning cash and a lot more of it because we got a lot more people.
Yeah.
And then you sell a bunch of stuff and you feel great about it. You're like, we're really good at our jobs. And that's not fair. So I think we need to go a full year to see. I don't expect this to be a home run. I expect it to be a single. And I will be very happy with a single in the first time we do a serious one like this. As far as integration and buy-in, a lot of the guys they're here as a job. It's not like they buy into the vision or mission of cutting grass. That's not necessarily what most of the guys are doing. And that's okay. It's not what I'd expect. But the guys that are here are being held to our standards. And a lot of them have totally thrived in this environment. It's been really fun. We had a Taco Tuesday. Try to do Taco Tuesday, first Tuesday of the month. You're welcome anytime. Kevin, not you, Eric.
And then, it on the calendar.
So it was the comment. I had that comment.
Yeah, it was what it was. But that it was fun to see some of the two companies sitting together. Like the guys were integrating more. And that's not perfectly. It's probably like, it's still us doing this, right? We're not here.
Sure.
But they're starting to overlap and they're getting more and more overlapped. And so that's really neat. And then the clients are this week, which we finalized a lot of the changing of the way that we do services. That's a huge relief. That's a big project. It was a big project we didn't understand we bought ourselves because what we thought we were buying from a services perspective was not what they were doing, which caused a whole bunch of extra work. So I guess it's another technical thing. When they say they're mowing lawns, what do they mean by mowing lawns? Because to us, that means cut the grass and leave. To them, it meant cut the grass, pull the weeds, trim the shrubs, wash the dog, and power wash.
Okay.
That's a bit of an exaggeration, but to some extent, their basic lawn package was three things. And to us, it's one.
Interesting.
And that changed a lot of what we were doing. And so we had to work through that and transition all those customers. And we lost a bunch of those customers. And a lot of those customers were frustrated. And there's some one-star reviews and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
All right. We are 60 minutes in. So let me ask you this question philosophically. What does cutting grass mean to you, Nolan? You chose to be in, you saw this business intimately for decades watching dad do it, and then you chose to follow in his footsteps. Certainly it's more than just a business and more than just dollars and cents to you. So why grass?
You implied we were 60 minutes in and therefore we were finishing, but then you asked a 60 minute question. So
this is part two. This episode will air the next week.
Or we'll just trim out the first 60 minutes and we'll just go with the second 60 minutes.
So was that a lawn care joke? Okay.
Ooh.
I like landscaping. I'm not into landscaping. I'm not like, and I don't think my dad is either. There is a cool thing about service businesses where like most things you do from a service perspective degrade. If you're a janitor, like the building still gets a little bit worse each year until you redo the carpets. If you're a painter, it gets, and something, landscaping is one of the unique things where it actually will improve if you take care of it. The trees get bigger, and if you take care of them, they get more beautiful and grand. The grass can become more lush and deeper roots and all the things if you're doing this really well. So it is actually one of the few places where at a service business, you can actually net improve the world, which I find really cool. But I am a small business guy before I'm a landscaping guy. I could do pools or pests, maybe not just because my wife would not love me killing butterflies, but I could do AC plumbing. I like people and I like heavy human businesses and I like service businesses and I could do commercial or residential. I like the residential side because of the unique parts of marketing and writing and stuff that I enjoy doing. But I honestly am not a big lawn guy. My yard looks pretty bad, to be honest. I blame my kids, but it's not
You don't subscribe to your own services? Are you admitting that right now on the air, Nolan?
No, I do subscribe to my services and my kids still destroy my yard because they're cattle.
Gotcha. Understood.
Yeah.
I love
it. There's only so much you can do.
I hear you. Nolan, we always like to wrap up with giving folks the opportunity to plug what they're working on, what's next, where people can find you, anything you want to shout out. So would love for you to let people know if they want to learn more about your business, your story, how they can reach you, and anything else you want to plug before we sign off.
There's probably one person in Central Texas. I know you guys have a huge following all over the US, but if you're in Central Texas and you want us to mow your lawn, you let us know. Otherwise, I just enjoy this stuff. I don't really have a product or a thing. I hope to be helpful. I hope to meet interesting people. And so that's why I'm doing it. It's fun to talk to you guys. I don't really have a way that I win aside from just hanging out. You can follow me and read some interesting stuff or not so interesting stuff about running a landscaping business on the Twitters. And no, seriously, I had fun. Really fun. Appreciate you guys.
Yeah, no, really appreciate you making the time for us.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, Nolan, and really appreciate you bringing your beard with you as well.
Anytime, Eric, for you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Mundane Millionaires. If you enjoyed what you heard in this episode, make sure to follow Mundane Millionaires wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. See you next time.